Hello, everyone. It's Tom Slater here. We've got a brilliant episode of Last Orders for you today. But before we get into that, I just want to let you all know about a very special event that we have coming up on Monday evening to mark the publication of Brendan O'Neill's brilliant new book, A Heretic's Manifesto. We're hosting a sort of online book launch exclusively for Spiked supporters. Brendan will be interviewed by the great Andrew Doyle, plus they'll be taking audience questions. Those who donate regularly to Spiked can claim their free ticket on the online donor hub now. So if you fancy coming along, but you're not a regular Spiked donor as yet, then now is surely the perfect time to sign up. For as little as £5 each month, you can get your ticket to this brilliant event. And you can also unlock many more exclusive perks, including ad-free reading of Spiked and access to our comment section. You can find out more about Spiked supporters and how to sign up at spiked-online.com/supporters. Then you just need to fill in your details, set up your £5 or more monthly donation and claim your free ticket for Monday. Once again, that's Brendan O'Neill and Andrew Doyle on Monday evening at 7 p.m. Don't miss it. Now, on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the worst nanny states in Europe, the campaign for drug liberalisation, and why drinking can be good for you. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked. Joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here, as always.
And we're delighted to also be joined today by Paul North. Paul is the director of VaultFast, which is an advocacy and communications organisation aimed at evidence-based drug policy reform. Paul, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having us on the show. And Chris, I apologise for breaking your computer mere minutes before starting.
That's all right. We're both speaking from Worthing today. Listeners, me and Paul are near neighbours, and he's just broken my computer. And I'm now sat in his living room recording this on my mobile phone.
Scowling at me.
We shall persist anyway. But there's a couple of nanny state stories, and also want to get into the whole drugs question. But Chris, we should start with the Nanny State Index. This is the annual project that you run over at the IEA looking at Europe and the various different policies in relation to alcohol and smoking and food and much else besides. It's just come out this week. So do you want to tell us a little bit about how the league table is looking, where the UK is in the mix, and some of the name and shame, essentially, what's been going on?
Yeah, happy to. It's actually a biennial thing. Fortunately, it's quite an exhausting project. It takes months and months to do. So we've got 30 countries in there. We keep adding new countries. Every time we do, they tend to push the UK down a little bit. So we had Norway and Iceland in recent years. Now we've got Turkey, which went straight to the number one spot because it's terrible on everything, particularly booze, unsurprisingly. So, you know, 90% Muslim majority. So Turkey is the number one nanny state, followed by countries such as Lithuania, Finland, Norway, Hungary, Ireland. Bit of a mixed bag, really. You know, you've got a couple of fairly autocratic countries there in Hungary and Turkey. Then you've got a couple of fairly predictable paternalistic Scandinavian countries, Ireland, and Lithuania, which is one of a number of Eastern European countries to be really clamping down on energy drinks and e-cigarettes and alcohol. The overall picture is pretty depressing if you are a freedom-minded person. Germany's still a reasonable place to go if you want to have a smoke and a drink and don't want to be hassled about what you eat. And Czech Republic, Spain, Italy, quite a few of the Mediterranean countries are still fairly good, but it's all relative. Everywhere's getting worse gradually. There's about three bits of liberalisation I could mention, literally. Norway has got rid of its sugar tax. Spain has legalised spirits advertising, but only between 1 o'clock and 5 o'clock in the morning.
So, you take the wins where you can get them, I guess.
That's something. And I think somewhere like Slovakia has allowed booze advertising from 8 p.m. instead of 10 p.m. It's pretty slim pickings in terms of libertarianism. And the UK is 11th, up from 12th last time. It would be a lot higher up if it didn't have such a sensible view of e-cigarettes, which, of course, is now under threat. But for the time being, Ireland and the UK are actually pretty good on e-cigarettes. But it's awful on smoking. It's like the worst of the 30 for smoking. It's second worst for food and soft drinks. and it's around about 12 for alcohol, mainly because it's frozen alcohol duty many years in the last sort of decade. But that'll be changing in August because we're going to see double-digit inflation-linked rises in all the booze taxes, I think. And there's more like food and drink regulation to come. So it'll probably be in the top 10 next time. But yeah, the big picture is that everywhere is getting worse. It's all quite depressing. I don't even understand why all these countries decide to do these things, but they do. And the other point I would make quickly is there is such a huge amount of variation. You know, the difference between Turkey and Germany or Czech Republic and Norway is just enormous. For all the European Union's attempts to kind of standardize and harmonize everything, it's actually domestic governments doing this. And it's all down to them. And as ever, you know, I think this is the fifth edition of the index. And all of them have found the same thing, that if you try and match up the nanny state scores to life expectancy or other kind of primary measures, smoking rate, per capita alcohol consumption, there's just no correlation at all. So it really is pretty pointless, all this stuff. And all you have to do to see this is get on a plane and go somewhere else where they don't have these silly rules. And you notice that actually these countries are perfectly well-functioning, happy, prosperous places. So what really is the point of it all?
Mm-hmm. And Paul, was there anything from what Chris was just describing there or what you've seen in this year's index that surprised you, stuck out to you?
It's really interesting, actually, because this is like a reverse league table of who's doing what I would view as quite well with regards to drug policy reform, particularly cannabis. So Germany, Czech Republic, Italy, Spain, Malta, Portugal, all taking quite progressive stances with regards to drug policy. And then the countries at the top are simply awful. You know, Turkey, again, this being the worst offender when it comes to drugs. The UK coming in at 11. I would probably put the UK in a similar position if we were to be thinking about how progressive the UK has been with regards to drugs. So I think there is an interesting comparison there that those, I guess it's not a huge surprise with regards to the way in which the countries at the bottom of the table treat drugs policy. You know, if they're being fairly liberal with regards to tobacco and alcohol, it's a fair bet that they're being fairly liberal with regards to cannabis and other drug policies. But it's kind of, there is that comparison there. Just to echo Chris's point, really, I think when I look at that list of countries, even though at the bottom of the table, I can talk about some of the things that are taking place in Germany and Malta and the Czech Republic. There's a lot of frustration in the drug policy community when we're looking at Europe and what's taking place.
And Chris, back to the sort of the nanny state stuff, because as I understand it, the sort of table is for things that are broadly speaking sort of legal, but are being kind of eaten away at, clamped down upon, and so on. One thing that kind of stuck out was there seems to now be the kind of, the smoking ban is its triumph has been total, it seems like. So there's just nowhere in the countries that you looked at where you could go to a bar and they might just let you smoke inside of it or whatever. Is that one of those things where you feel like that's just over now and they're just moving further and further down the ladder of lifestyle things to go after?
It's not quite that bad. Serbia actually this week brought in a smoking ban. I don't know how extensive it is. A lot of people in the UK, because we're so parochial here, kind of assume that other countries, if you read about a smoking ban, it means they've got a smoking ban like we've got a smoking ban. In other words, you can't smoke anywhere at all. You know, no smoking rooms, you know, train platforms, can't even smoke, you know, on stage in a theatrical production. Most countries aren't like that. There's only really a few places in Germany where the kind of status quo in pubs is that you can basically smoke. But even then, I think they often have some kind of restrictions. But no, I mean, the majority of countries in Europe, except for Ireland and the UK primarily, have some kind of exemptions. Even pretty draconian places like Finland, they still have kind of smoking rooms of some sort. Denmark still have actually quite a relaxed smoking ban for the time being. So whether it will ultimately all go to a kind of British-style smoking ban, I don't know. Actually, the thing with smoking bans is, and the reason that anti-smoking activists are so keen to make sure they are, quote, comprehensive from day one, is that once you allow a system in which the assumption is, you know, the standard is that you don't smoke, but there is some accommodation for smokers. Once you have that, then there isn't actually that much grassroots support for going further, because the non-smokers are perfectly happy. They've got basically the pubs to themselves, and they don't begrudge smokers having a bit of space either. Whereas the anti-smokers, because they're not interested in creating a system that works for everyone, they just want to stop people smoking. They would, in some cases, have in the past actually failed to support a smoking ban because it's not total. They would rather bide their time and wait for the total smoking ban. But so, yeah, I mean, Czech Republic was very relaxed about smoking until a few years ago. Now they've got a very draconian ban. And don't get me wrong, there are some countries which have basically a total ban, but they are still in the minority. You have to put up with often quite a pokey little smoking room, and you're not allowed to take your drink in some places. But there is more accommodation for smokers in Europe, generally speaking, than there is in Britain.
And Paul, you were talking there about, or gesturing to, some of the countries that you feel are doing well in Europe on drug policy. It'd be good to hear a little bit more about that, because we are going to get onto drugs in a bit. When we get to that, it'd be good to kind of focus a bit on the UK and where we're at. So where in Europe, you mentioned a few cases there, but just expand a little bit about what they're doing right in your view.
Yeah, sure. Germany, I think at the moment, is the most interesting one, although there is a bigger, there's a bigger picture at play with Germany. On the surface, it looks great because Germany recently announced that they're going to launch a full adult use legal cannabis market, much like Canada, where me and Chris have been and kind of seen firsthand how the Canadian market's doing. So Germany kind of announced we're going to do this big adult use legal market. But then over the past few months have started to gradually roll back on it and change the policies, change their approach. So rather than being this kind of quite exciting, people will be able to just rock up, buy and consume cannabis completely legally, grow it at home, you know, no intervention from the law. Instead, they've moved it back due to pressure from the EU. And also what I think, just the strength of the public health lobby. I think they've got stressed by the public health lobby and don't want to upset anybody. So now they've gone to sort of like, they've turned it into a pilot project. It's going to be like a pilot project for 5 years. And that pilot project is going to be very limited in exploring potential corporate models. And it's going to focus on just setting up cannabis social clubs, which, although from a policy perspective, I'm certainly not against. I think they're an interesting opportunity for people to come together and grow cannabis through a collective and consume and use cannabis offsite. It's still quite a niche model, and it doesn't really appease the public. And fundamentally, when I look at the state of drug policy in Europe, I think we should be approaching this issue to take power away from criminal gangs, to reduce the level of criminality and the amount of the money that's made for criminal gangs, the amount of people that are criminalized, and really protect people. I think there's a good opportunity to protect people through sensible models of regulation. But Germany have yielded a little bit too much to that public health lobby and instead put a system forward which is nowhere near what we're seeing in North America. So I was initially excited about it, but now I'm skeptical. There's some other interesting stuff that's going on. There's a bunch of, like, Luxembourg are going to do a full adult use legal market. The Czech Republic recently announced that they were going to do a full adult legal market. You know, there's decriminalization schemes in Portugal. There's medical markets in most of those countries that are on the nanny state index.
Luxembourg is the one that interests me because it's obviously a tiny little place, but it borders God knows how many countries. Borders from like 6 countries, isn't it?
Yeah.
So once they start having a commercial market in cannabis, I mean, people are just going to nip in and nip out, aren't they?
Well, this was my hope for Germany.
The dam's going to burst, you would think.
I'd said for a while about Germany, when Germany goes fully legal, the bordering countries will then have to take action. But that's where the tension point occurred with the EU, and Germany had to start reeling back because of a lot of the Schengen Protocol agreements. They had to start surrendering. Luxembourg might be a different position by which their I guess, implementation of the model will create a system by which people can just nip over a border. As someone that's passionate about evidence-based, sensible drug policy reform, I'm certainly in favour of cannabis legalisation. Other drugs, I'd take a much, much more cautious approach. I'm hoping it's a country like Luxembourg who can be quite brave and bold and basically put a system in place that, because I think the biggest, I won't go too much of a rant on this, but I think the biggest problem we have in drug policy and in the areas that you're interested in alcohol policy and smoking policy, is politicians are very disconnected from what the public actually want and what the average person wants to see. I don't think people, I know you're going to come on to it, because I don't think people want like big warning labels and to be stressed out and to be scared. People want educating like an adult, right? And I think cannabis policy is the same thing. I think the average person wants to be able to sensibly consume cannabis, or maybe not sensibly consume it, through their own decision-making process and choice. And I think if in mainland Europe we can get a country by which people can demonstrate that intention, I think policymakers will change their mind. Because as we've seen with Germany, we're going to legalize cannabis. We're going to do this. That I think they're willing. A lot of politicians are willing to make quite bold statements and positions if they feel like the public support is there. And as we've seen in Germany, the public didn't go mad. The parties suggested, the coalition suggested, we're going to legalize cannabis, and the public went, okay. Same in Canada, Trudeau, we're going to legalize cannabis, and the public went, all right, that's fine. They didn't really kick off. So I think what we're missing in Europe is a situation like that, Chris, where people can demonstrate that freedom of choice and say, I want to consume cannabis. And guess what? Everything's fine. The society hasn't collapsed. It's fine. It's quite boring, if anything.
Definitely. And Chris, before we go back to drugs and talking a bit about the UK, let's move away from the whole Europe picture, but let's talk about Ireland for a second, because this is something I know you've written about, a kind of recent development whereby the EU have given the Irish government the green light to introduce particular alcohol warnings. It's caused some consternation elsewhere in Europe, who are worried it will scare them away from their Italian wines and so on. But you wrote about this and kind of made the point that it does feel like it's part of an attempt, these warnings, to almost equate the risk around alcohol to something like smoking. Do you want to tell us a bit more about what's been going on there?
Yeah, they want to put cigarette-style warnings on booze, basically. And the sort of temperance lobby, the public health lobby, go, well, how can you be against that? We're just giving people information, which on one level is fair enough, except that I don't really believe that the temperance lobby is interested in giving people information. I think they're interested in scaring people off alcohol. And if you look at the warnings that have been mooted here, they're quite misleading. I mean, they focus a lot on cancer. I think one of the warnings says something along the lines of alcohol directly causes a number of cancers. All right. Well, technically, that is true, I suppose, but there's no mention there of excessive drinking. There's no mention of how much you have to drink in order to increase your risk of cancer. There's no mention of what the cancers are, and the majority of them are really quite rare. And if people knew what the increase in risk was, I don't think they would even think it worth having a label on. I mean, the increased risk of breast cancer, which is the only cancer that isn't rare, which is associated with alcohol use, it's like a 25% increase risk if you have 2 or 3 glasses a day. So not totally trivial, but actually the same as the risk from taking a contraceptive pill, right? A lot of people probably don't know that the contraceptive pill is linked to breast cancer. It hasn't got warnings on it, and public health people don't exactly go out of their way to tell women about this risk. But it's there. Is it worth not taking the pill for? Probably not. Is the risk not worth drinking for if you like drinking? Probably not. But anyway, it doesn't. The warnings aren't going to get into that kind of level of detail. So it's not really very useful just to say basically alcohol kills, alcohol causes cancer. It's going to give people a sense that the risk is much bigger than it is. And that's not good. It's going to make people worry about this a lot more than they should do. So I don't believe they're acting in good faith. I think that the only reason really they want these warnings is to scare people and to sort of break open the door for more tobacco-style regulation. And the state that smokers are in these days basically treated as second-class citizens. It all began with the warning labels, which I think were justified in the case of cigarettes. But once you started down that road, everything else then followed. It took decades before you ended up with like the shadow health secretary saying, let's prohibit tobacco completely. But they got there, and now they've got the anti-tobacco blueprint. They probably feel they can get there a lot faster with alcohol. So I just don't believe that we should trust these people or trust their motives. I think that they want to treat alcohol like tobacco, and that's why they're focusing a great deal on cancer warning labels, even though cancer is by no means the biggest risk associated with alcohol. There's much more important things to talk about if you want to give people information about the health effects of booze.
And one line that you touch on that you're hearing a lot from the public health lobby, or more from the public health lobby these days, is that there's no safe level of alcohol. I said, do you want to knock that down, unpack that for us? Because it's something that you keep hearing in these circles these days.
Well, that is based on the idea that any amount of alcohol increases your risk of cancer, which is probably not true. It may possibly be true in the case of breast cancer, but it's really hard to tell because there's not actually that many people who drink very small quantities of alcohol to study. And you can't be sure they're telling the truth when they do say they drink small quantities of alcohol. So that's what that is based on. But they also ignore and disparage and downplay the significant benefits of drinking alcohol in fairly moderate quantities, which I'm sure we've discussed before, but there's really no doubt to anybody who's got eyes to see that moderate drinking is associated with lower mortality risk, lower heart disease risk, lower stroke risk, and a few other things, probably lower diabetes risk too. So there are real benefits to drinking alcohol in moderation. They're not going to be mentioning those on these labels, obviously, because they don't want to give you the full picture. They don't really want people to be educated. If anything, they try and stop people getting information like that because it to them sends a wrong signal. So yeah, again, it's all about copying the anti-smoking campaigners. You know, they want to say no safe level because that's what they said with smoking. Then they said it about secondhand smoke. They'll probably say about thirdhand smoke soon. And they're certainly saying about alcohol. Once you establish that there is no safe level and that there are no health benefits from something, it obviously makes it a lot easier to say, well, the ideal quantity to consume is zero. And the way to get people to consume zero is to do what we've done with smoking. And that's where we're going to be.
The same old playbook, drinkers be warned, as you said at the end of your last critic piece. But Paul, let's go back to drugs and the UK, if you don't mind, just because it feels like we're at an interesting point. The debate feels very muddled, but also because of the fact that if the direction is anything, it's in the way of more restrictions, of more prohibition. We've recently seen the government essentially ban possession of nitrous oxide, a drug so dangerous that they give it to women during childbirth. You've got the Labour Party, because it's on a kind of law and order tip at the moment, very keen to sound as authoritarian on the drugs question as the Tories. Is it all doom and gloom in the UK, do you think, or are there any kind of bright spots where kind of more liberal policies are concerned?
It's very frustrating at the moment looking at the UK, particularly just zooming out briefly and recognising that in 2018, under probably one of the most socially conservative leaders, prime ministers we've had for a long time, we saw the legalisation of cannabis for medical use. So any adult in the UK can go get a medical cannabis prescription through a private clinician. That, in 2018, created a lot of optimism around, oh, wow, okay, that's taken place under a prime minister that we really, one, didn't want to do it, and two, never would want to see it happen in the House. So
Theresa May, if I remember correctly.
Right. Yeah.
Not a natural liberal in any stretch of the imagination, but yeah.
Not at all, yeah. I mean, there were campaigns. I mean, we ran one of those campaigns. There were campaigns that certainly put her on the back foot, but the fact was we'd seen a serious change in our legislation, and we kind of were amongst a number of countries kind of making progressive reforms to our drug policy laws. So that felt like quite a positive moment. But years later, you know, coming on 6 years later, it's very, very frustrating in the drug policy space at the moment. And you alluded to the reason for that. I feel like drug policy, and there are a number of policies in which I think there are strong moral reactions from the public. And when you find those strong moral reactions, I think politicians grab those subjects, and rather than engaging with them from the intention of, okay, what's best for the public? Like what would create better, more enjoyable, positive experiences for the public? They look at policies and go, what do we need to say here to either rally our base a little? Like they think tactically. So the NOS ban was a good example of this. You know, the Conservative government knew that if they just clamped down on NOS, they could run some nice, strong headlines about how they were tackling antisocial behaviour and littering. And there's some truth in that. Like there is an issue with littering and nitrous oxide. Let's go to any festival and you see it in abundance. I think there are issues with littering generally, and that's more the issue. But, you know, you can see why people get frustrated with NOS. But rather than following the advice of the Advisory Council for Misuse of Drugs, who specifically said, do not make this a Class B, you will increase harm, they did exactly that. But it went down quite well with their base. You know, there was lots of, for them, they would view as quite strong headlines. But you also alluded to the fact that you see this with Labour now as well. You know, I've spent years lobbying Labour politicians. Chris and I have been to Canada with a prominent Labour politician and shown them firsthand the strength of a legal market. You know, it's not that exciting. It's fairly evidence-based. They came back and said, I think we should reform our cannabis laws. But once these politicians are in positions of power and influence and kind of under Starmer, they don't want to touch it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want anything to do about it, because Labour recognise that it's almost a weak spot for them to stand up and say anything progressive on drugs. The Tories can hit them in seats and areas where it hurts. And that, I just find quite a sad state of affairs generally, not just for drug policy, but just for the issues that, you know, serious issues in society, because I think we've created a relationship with a number of policy areas where politicians aren't engaging with it in an evidence-based way. You know, what's good for the people? They're engaging it in a gamified way. They're sitting down going, what's good for us? How can we get more votes? How can we get more seats? And there may come a day in the near future, in the next few years, maybe under a Labour government, where drug policy will come will be in one of those conversations, but instead they will think, okay, let's legalize, let's be progressive, let's create a legal adult use cannabis market. But we're just not there at the moment in the UK.
And is it the case that this is where the public is or where the public is perceived to be? Because you made the point earlier that on certain questions, at least, the public are often, you know, more open to some of these policies than otherwise might be, we might be led to believe. I mean, some of the kind of response, I remember the sort of anti-NOS stuff in some of the newspapers, it felt decidedly retro in some respects. You know, you kind of do get a sense of, is this actually perfectly in step with where people are? So is the problem necessarily that the public are yet to be convinced of the case for a lot of these liberalisations? Or is it a case of the base of particular newspapers, of certain people that certain parties don't want to upset, rather than the people at large?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's sometimes hard to tell unless you're doing really regular polling. The most recent polls suggest that over 50% support a legal adult use cannabis market. There are around 30% that would strongly oppose, but something like 20-25% would be, you know, they'd support like decriminalization, and then like 55% legal adult use markets. But the real problem you've got when polling the public is sometimes the public's perception of what decriminalization is and legalization is a bit off kilter. So it's quite, even in those polls, it's quite hard to get a say. I mean, my inclination would be that the public are way more supportive of cannabis reform than politicians perceive them to be, mainly because, like, we see it taking place around the globe, in North America, Canada, as I've talked about, in Germany, and you're just not seeing massive moral reactions from the public. You definitely get people who say, I'm not happy with this, I'm against it. But I don't think we're a million miles away from those jurisdictions with regards to our kind of social makeup and positioning. I know typically the UK can be seen as a bit more of a socially conservative country. We can sort of be a little bit more centre-right. But I just don't feel like the Canadian model in particular would cause a great deal of outcry, especially if politicians truly engaged with it and started talking about some of the other areas, like, you know, science and innovation and job creation, like economic trade. It's just, I don't feel like it's as controversial as the papers make out.
And what do you think, Chris? I mean, as Paul was saying there, you went and saw the Canadian model for yourself. Do you think it's something that we could be adopting anytime soon?
I don't think we will do, no. But if Germany actually do it properly, or Luxembourg becomes this huge sort of the cannabis tourist hotspot, and one or two other countries follow, you know, all it takes is, as Paul says, for it to visibly not be a disaster and actually to bring in quite a bit of money for the government, and governments will do it. So you keep waiting for the dominoes to fall, but it's a very slow process. And you can't blame politicians for, you know, responding to what they think the national mood is. The question is whether they've actually judged the national mood correctly. Yeah, politics is politics. There's no point crying about it and saying, why don't these people act on their convictions or follow the evidence? They're going to do whatever they can do to get re-elected. It's a little bit like, you know, the war on smokers, you know, in particular, but also the, you know, war on gamblers to some extent, and even the war on drinkers. It's, you know, if you don't make yourself heard, it doesn't matter how many millions of you there are, the politicians may judge a national mood based on how many phone calls they get from prohibitionists and what newspapers are saying. So there's various ways politicians can engage a national mood. Obviously, opinion polls are one thing. I tend to think that politicians don't really do anything if there's a third or more of the population against it, as a rough rule of thumb. Because even if the majority want it and the minority don't, the minority often can be quite vociferous. And there's a sort of status quo bias in politics, generally speaking, for perfectly reasonable kind of conservative reasons, you know, that if it ain't broke, you know, don't fix it. But the thing is, with drugs, obviously it is broke. It desperately needs fixing. Cannabis users, I don't think, generally speaking, are the best advocates for their own position, nor for any position, really, because they're always smoking cannabis. Just because you're a drug user doesn't necessarily mean you even want to legalize the things. You might not want everybody else taking them. So I guess, again, the parallel there with smokers who've been absolutely hopeless defending their own rights, and some of whom actively want more regulation to give them a commitment device to quit. So it's very difficult. It's a slow process. I do think it will happen eventually, but I think we're talking many years, really.
And it is interesting as well, because we've been talking so much about the nanny states issues where, you know, we've got a future Labour government saying that it might end up actually just banning cigarettes in one way, form or another. And I get, Paul, that at the moment, this current Labour Party is not particularly interested in liberalisation for the reasons that we've talked about. I guess the difficulty is there isn't a kind of across-the-board argument in favour of you should be able to put in your body whatever you like, so long as it doesn't harm anyone else. That is not really a principle that seems to hold forth today. And so you just have a kind of strange situation where in some areas of lifestyle, we're going in a slightly authoritarian direction. It's not going great in drugs, but at least there's interest in it. So I suppose it's the problem, the fact that we've always had, to use your phrase, kind of evidence-based discussions rather than trying to appeal to a kind of more of a principled stance, which is to say this doesn't harm anyone other than the person who's actually engaging in it. Even so, a lot of the harms are often exaggerated. Leave people to make up their own decisions. Is that not an argument that should be revisited, do you think, given there's such a muddled picture at the moment?
Yeah, in the notes, actually, I'd put down that I was thinking before the show, like, politically, why have we got like a Labour Party and a Tory party kind of taking quite similar positions on drug policy? And I think we've kind of lost the like libertarian argument and strength in the House. We've lost that kind of like libertarian position with regards to drug policy, which I think can unite both sides, because even though both parties aren't really battling over drug policy at the moment, they're kind of aligning. If one of them were to take a strong position, I think the other would just oppose it, and you would just see this kind of like battening down the hatches, no one really getting anywhere. Whereas if we had a bit, you've seen in other countries in like North America, where there has been more of a liberal reform, you've got quite a strong libertarian position, which is outlined. And I think that, because there aren't many libertarians owning the position, I think that's creating a bit of a vacuum. And also, we're just missing, in the UK, we're missing people like Sir Norman Lamb. And, you know, a strong Lib, well, I don't know whether they've ever been strong for a long time, but a Lib Dem party who can maybe grab onto some of these more progressive stances and take the House and take the argument on a little bit of a journey and unify. Because in the absence of people like Sir Norman Lamb, the Lib Dems have just completely abandoned the issue, and Starmer's been allowed to just run off. Because I've met chief of staff from Labour politicians and spoke to them about it, and it's quite clear that Starmer's given a really strict message to Labour on, you know, we don't deviate from the line here. We're going to be tough on drugs. We're not going to go soft. We're not going to start doing anything too wild. Although at the same time, and again, as you mentioned, there are some other interesting things taking place with like psychedelic research and medicines. You know, you had Charlotte Nichols, Labour MP, Crispin Blunt, Tory MP, Ronnie Cowan, all speaking quite positively around the need for the rescheduling of psilocybin, magic mushrooms, so we could start doing more therapeutic trials and interventions. And I don't feel like that as an issue is as controversial as cannabis. I think if we were to put to the public, should we reschedule psilocybin so that we can do more trials around the benefits of psychedelic medicine, I think the public would be like, yeah, go for it. They don't see that as a particularly scary, controversial thing. So what we might actually see is cannabis remain this kind of hot potato and something that, due to, you know, the media always want to write quite punchy articles about cannabis, politicians don't want to go near it. We might see drugs like ketamine and psilocybin actually come through and being prescribed in therapeutic settings, and that might overtake cannabis. But yeah, I think one of the problems is we don't really have many true libertarians championing and engaging with the issue at the moment.
I think Liberal Democrats in particular don't know what they're about other than opposing people building houses in rural areas and things like that. But that was really interesting. We should try and squeeze in a couple of postbag questions from our listeners.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
I haven't got the name of this person, so I'm sorry that I haven't read it out. But what is the best and dumbest possible product for a government to cap in price? I suppose let's focus on dumbest rather than best. Maybe that would be a little bit straightforward. Chris, any thoughts about what product would be absolutely idiotic to cap in price at this point, coming off of the back of Rishi Sunak allegedly mooting this possibility?
Well, given that price caps only lead to shortages, you would probably have to say food, wouldn't you, really? Imagine that. Imagine suggesting you have a price cap on food and you run out of loads of food. No, I mean, just a terrible idea. I don't know why they even flew this kite in the first place, because obviously it was going to get shot down by anybody who even has a vague understanding of economics. You can understand it if it's Richard Murphy or somebody piping up, but the Treasury suggesting it, I think it was. And they said it was going to be voluntary price caps, you know, the old voluntary ban. What is a voluntary price cap? Basically, they're just going to go grovelling to Tesco's and say, please, will you put your price of milk down a bit with it? And Tesco is quite rightly going to say, well, we only make tiny margins to start with. What do you want us to do? It's kind of pathetic. It kind of shows how desperate the government is to get down inflation and how surprised it is that it stayed more persistent than it and the Bank of England expected, but not so much as some people expected.
Paul, any hot takes on price caps?
The most stupid one would be something like toilet roll, wouldn't it? Because even if that is some very rare scenarios would work, people would just panic and buy all the toilet roll in the world ever, as we found out during COVID. Just never mention toilet roll.
God, I've forgotten about the toilet roll. Right, that was when you knew things were really getting real. We've got one more here, which is about another thing Sunak has done recently, to much consternation. This is from Christopher Owens. He says, with the reports of Sunak only repealing 800 EU laws, what is the legacy of Brexit? Chris, just to kick that to you, maybe with a bit of a nanny state spin, are there Brexit benefits in the nanny state front that aren't being harnessed because of this sort of approach?
I'm not that worried about this thing of not repealing every law. I think people massively underestimate how complicated it is to repeal EU law. It's not like there's a big shelf of EU law in the House of Commons. All you have to do is go back and say, right, we're not doing this after all. It's all been woven into British law in various different ways. And a lot of the EU laws are actually perfectly all right, and we voted for them in the first place. And we just have to replace them with exactly the same thing, which would be pointless. Or it's woven into other laws that we created and we also quite like. So I think really Brexiteers, of whom I am one, should just say, look, we want to get rid of this, 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 and this because of this reason, this reason, this reason, and then do that, rather than just kind of assuming that all EU law is holding the country back and we need to get rid of it, because it can't, it's a simple matter of time and motion, it can't be done. So I get a bit concerned when Brexiteers are unable to point to the kind of laws they want to get rid of and instead just go, well, we'll get rid of all of them and hope for the best. It's a silly approach. It's not a serious approach. And I think people need to get over it. Yeah, there haven't been that many benefits of Brexit. There have been some. Can't think of one immediately coming to mind, but there have been some. And I think the long-term picture has always been that I think politicians are always quite unlikely to repeal many laws for reasons good and bad. But if the EU carries on, and for example, to take an area of my interest, it looks like they might be putting a tax, an EU-wide tax on e-cigarette fluid. It's possible they might be banning e-cigarette flavours. Well, if the EU does do that in 2026, hopefully our government wouldn't follow the EU blindly in that stupid direction. So that would be a benefit. So I think it's kind of deviating from the EU as we move forward, which is probably going to bring bigger benefits than repealing stuff that's already on the books. But that doesn't mean people shouldn't be nominating things on the books to be repealed.
And you're forgetting the major Brexit benefit, of course, which is actually more democratic control over all of this stuff, which we shouldn't forget in the midst of all those silly arguments with Remainers on the internet. But Chris, is there anything that's kind of nanny state specific that we've carried over that we should just get rid of? Because surely there's loads of lifestyle related things which have just been passed into UK law without anyone much noticing,
Only with regards to tobacco and alcohol, actually. And we massively gold-plated all the stuff on tobacco. So I wouldn't think we'd repeal things like the advertising ban and graphic warnings. E-cigarettes has always been a good opportunity to get rid of some of the silly, silly laws they have, just daft restrictions on the size of your e-cigarette tank and the amount of nicotine you can have in the vape juice. We didn't need that stuff. The snus ban needs overturning. But whether or not the government will grasp that nettle, it doesn't look like it. They've had plenty of opportunities to do it so far. But now, actually, the EU, going back to the nanny state index, I mentioned that, there's such divergence between the different countries, huge difference between, Lithuania and the Czech Republic, for example. So obviously, that's not the EU done that. The EU have done a few things, but not really in the area of alcohol at all. And they haven't done anything at all with food and soft drinks. It's just a bit of stuff on tobacco and e-cigarettes, of which countries like the UK have gone far ahead of anyway.
And Paul, I've got one question for you, which I've taken to asking our guests, given the fact that this is quite a libertarian podcast. If you had to have one ban, what would it be? And it can't be a kind of worthy thing. You can't ban the war on drugs. You can't ban hunger, something that just irks you. Like Chris's example is wheelie suitcases. So let us know.
The thing that is really, really irritating me beyond belief at the moment is subscription services that slide in adverts. I think this is disgraceful. Like Amazon at the moment, Now TV, which I pay for, I will Yeah, cool. Let's watch the latest episode of Succession. It will then just play me an advert for something. I'm like, what? And I can't get, I'm like, what? You, what? Why are you giving me an advert? I pay you a subscription fee so I can press play and immediately start watching the show. I wish we would legislate against that. If someone pays a fee, they get the product. Don't give them any ad. They can click a button that says, I'm an idiot, I want to see an advert before every show, or I'm out of ideas, show me a program. But I hate the fact that I don't have a choice. It's like a minute and a half advert as well.
That's a perfect opportunity to say that if you donate £5 a month to Spiked, you can read it ad-free now, amongst many other benefits.
Nice feature.
So please go and do that. Thank you both very much. Chris, Paul, we'll let you get back to your day.
Cheers.
Cheers, mate.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.